I'm Joseph.
And I'm Nick.
And this is Fish Jelly. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. I was reading that Aaron Taylor Johnson, who is an actor, and I know him from, he's in that movie with Brad Pitt on the train, right?
Bullet Train, yeah. He's in many things.
And wasn't he a superhero in something?
He was in Kick-Ass.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he's, like, the rumors that he'll be the new James Bond.
Oh, God.
But that's not what I was going to talk about.
Okay.
He did an interview with Vanity Fair. So this guy, when he was 22, he married a lady who was 46.
Sam What's-Her-Face. Yeah.
Who's a director.
Yeah, she directed him in a movie called Lonely Boy or something.
Nowhere Boy.
Nowhere Boy, yeah.
About John Lennon.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the interview, responding to a question about people talking about him getting married so young and having children, he said, what you got to realize is that what most people were doing in their 20s, I was doing when I was 13. You're doing something too quickly for someone else. I don't understand that. What speed are you supposed to enjoy life at? It's bizarre to me. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
But it caught my attention because on social media, people were saying how upsetting it is that the statement about him saying that he was doing things when he was 13 that most people do in their 20s, which, I mean, yeah, sure. Young people grow up too fast. And I don't know this actor and what his background is. I'm assuming he was a child actor, maybe.
No, I don't think so.
No, I mean.
But I mean, teenagers are sexually active. I was a young teenager who was sexually active. Teenagers are out there fucking, like, Jesus. I'm continually amused at how surprised people are learning that. Like,
well, what I was going to say is I think that, you know, some people love to tell you all the things they've done. And like, you know, like the minute you mention anything, it's like, well, I did that. And I have opinions about that just as far as like the image people present and how helpful that might be for them. But then this person, this actor, was just living his life. Like, it's not his fault that, I mean, he's famous.
But I don't think it's about presenting an image. I think it's an authentic statement about, like, we all have, we have developed in a certain way.
Well, it is about is presenting an image, because if you are, like, if all you do is talk about how, I mean, you know, people who talk about how they like doing drugs, and or people talk about how they are super sexually active, and or that they've been having sex since they were 13, it's like, well, then that does paint a picture of who you are. So then it's not about pretending that that's not who you are. But I also think that that will attract a certain... Right, if you go around telling everyone you like drugs, well, that will...
I think there's some key differences in some of those things, but I think it's important for people to authentically and realistically talk about life, and we're all sexual beings, and I think that it does all of us a disservice by pretending certain things don't happen. And
well, I'm definitely not saying people should pretend that things don't happen. I'm saying there's a way to present oneself to sort of respect their experience. You know, like, I feel like people don't put a lot of respect on their experience. It's almost like they're bragging.
Sure.
Like, oh, I was super slutty when I was 13. I was having sex with people three times my age. Like, it's cool. And it's like, well, like, as a 40-year-old, you think that that was cool and beneficial to you? I guess that's what I'm saying. The way people talk about things is like, okay, that's your truth, and it's an important part of who you are. But as a 40-year-old, does it make sense? Like, do you want people to think that as a 40-year-old, you think it's cool that you've done all the drugs? Like, in your 20s, you were just a full-on crackhead. Like, do you think that...
No, because as a 40-year-old, you're supposed to reflect on how those choices were perhaps had detrimental effects.
But I'm saying that there are some people with certain topics that if you even mention anything tangential to it, they will immediately pipe up like, well, here's my... Like, I did that. And it's like, okay. The reason I'm bringing that part of it up is because in this instance, this person who is famous was just doing their own thing, right? They weren't out here telling everyone, like, I'm attracted to this woman more than twice my age. And, you know, he just happened to, whatever their situation was, and he married her and have kids, that's his business. So I think it's funny that people seem to have a problem with it. And then his response to it is more in line with what I think you're saying, which is like, well, that was his, it's his life, his experience. And he felt like at that time he had had enough experience to know that he wanted to be with this lady. So the fact that, because then he says that, you know, you're doing something too quickly for someone else, question mark. Like, yeah, I guess if, you know, you were a virgin until you were 25 and married the first man you met and had sex with, then someone like him would seem.
But if that were somebody's trajectory, like, who is anybody else to say whether that's working for them or not? Like,
right.
It's
right.
We're all different, work at different speeds, have different capabilities. I don't know.
That's what I think. So I just find it funny. And also for any, like, you know, you weren't there to, because I guess people feel like he needed to be protected. And
it's like, well, people have been bothered about them since he was, since their union. But it's like, legally, he's an adult. So, I don't know. Like, but people want to stay bothered about other people's business. So
I just thought that was like reading the comments and.
Well, but again, that's this puritanical approach to everything, which is why I think it's important that everybody, it's not just about piping up and saying like, well, I did that too. It's making other people realize that this shit is common, and it's not about bragging rights. It's about, we all have been exposed to sexual stimulus at a young age, especially in this culture. And it's like, there are detrimental effects, I don't know.
Well, that's true too. I feel like people are so sensitive, but we also subject young people,
and
we sexualize young people.
Like, the children aren't animals. Yeah, I mean, well, we are, but it's like they're how they are consuming and interpreting and processing all of that. It's like people just want to sweep that shit under the rug and then be like, oh, it's so horrible that this man was a sexual being as a 13-year-old. It's like, well, come on now, let's not be new.
Yeah, I mean, obviously young people are doing things. Do I think the young people, do I think 13-year-olds should be having sex? No, but.
No, that's the thing. Like, that, if we were realistic about human beings and sexuality, there would be a logical way to approach that with teenagers who are a lot more aware than.
Well, yeah, if adults were talking to young people about their bodies and about sex and what they're going to feel and. You know, then maybe I would feel differently. But as it is, like, no.
I mean, if we were parents, if we had a girl, if we were rearing a girl, this abstinence shit only thing, that it never did work. But in a world where abortion is, well, we live in California, but, you know, trust that we would be having very blunt, very clear conversations.
Well, it's tricky because I feel like people don't feel comfortable talking about certain things. But then if you ask me, I'm not a parent, but I feel like if you're not equipped to talk to your child about certain like key life things, like, I mean,
I've gotten
in trouble for saying this before, but I kind of feel like if you're not prepared to instruct your child on basic arithmetic and grammar and life science, and I don't know, it just seems weird that then you would think like, well, I'm going to have a baby, and right, then I'm just going to shuttle this baby off to a school to let some stranger educate them on the most important topics of life, really. Mm-hmm. And you know, the public education system is still deficient in many ways, but I'm going to just shuttle them off and then, but then also have a very strong opinion about what the schools are doing to my kids. And it's like, well, I don't know. Again, I don't have kids. My inclination is that if I did, I would probably homeschool them, but that's because I am capable of teaching my child the basics. And then when they get to a point where I can, that's when I would probably send them off somewhere. But, you know, I don't know. Well,
people are uncomfortable with sex because they were never allowed to be comfortable and process it themselves. So it's a vicious cycle.
I just find it odd that, like, to have a child and then like know in the back of your mind that I would not be comfortable talking to them about things that you know from your own experience were uncomfortable for you. Mm-hmm. So it's like, why wouldn't you want to prepare me for like these inevitable things that my body's going to change, that I'm going to have feelings that I can't control, you know, like that I'm going to develop attachments to certain people and ideas and just be so like poorly equipped to handle any of it.
Right. And that's why as a species, the humans are barely at adolescence anyway. So
then it's like, you know, this 13-year-old, like if he was having sex at 13, by the time he met this lady, I mean, he was pretty seasoned.
Yes.
Now I still think, you know, if she was 40, I mean, I'm 45. So it's like, would I like seriously date a 22-year-old? No. Like, cause I just don't know what we would have in common. I mean,
it raises some eyebrows because of when you have life experiences, those things seem strange. But
well, I've interacted with people that age, and it's like they're very experienced in some ways.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And so,
but like maturity, like a relationship.
But I think it's deceptive because someone knows how to, you know, throw it back doesn't mean that they are like mature and emotionally
right. Can they communicate?
Like equipped to handle everything that goes with. And it's not about like they are an adult, but it's like to interact with someone who's twice your age, like middle aged. I mean, there's an entirely different set of.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's not for me.
I don't know. It just caught my attention because under the post, I was reading all these comments from people, and it's just like people are so judgmental. But I would love to know the person who wrote that comment, what their life is like, because your life is probably a mess. Like someone from his angle would look at your life and think like, God, what the fuck is you doing?
You had the time to come and comment about mine.
But there are some things that I do find. It does make me, you know, we're assuming that as a 13-year-old, he wasn't equipped, but maybe his parents were very open and honest with him. And maybe he did have a lot of the information someone like me didn't have. Because a lot of the people I know who were sexually active as teenagers, I think that it had a negative impact on them, primarily because they weren't equipped to handle these very adult situations.
Well, yeah, there's a psychological component to sex and a cultural one as well.
But I mean, like I said in the beginning, I don't know what it would be like if young people were very well equipped and had support and had open dialogue with their guardians, and so that they felt like they could get into these situations and make decisions that were maybe less detrimental to their like emotional development. But so I don't know anything about this man. You know, looking at him and her, it's like, well, I could see why she was chasing his ass. So that feels a little, I don't know. I mean, she's a nice looking lady too, but it coming from someone who's not a prude and who has done a lot of things, I think it's a little like, really, girl? Like, no, you don't think you're kind of old for it, but okay.
I'm sure they've heard that every day since they've been together somewhere.
But it's none of my business. Moving on to something silly. The other day I was driving, I'm saying West LA because that's what their website says, but it's technically not West LA. But I saw a store called Nifty After 50, which caught my attention. So then I was reading about it, and it's just like they're like these places, like health and wellness places that focus on fitness, for mature adults. But I thought the name was cute, and then it made me think that there was a chain. What year did those become popular? It was called Curves.
Oh, I mean, at least a decade ago or more.
Yeah.
Because my mom used to use that, I remember.
But I always thought the font of the signage was funny because it looks like almost like a female form that's a little more corpulent. Like, okay, that was a choice. Nifty After 50. My last thought was I was going to complain about on Instagram stories. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that people, so they'll post a story and then they'll type something in like the smallest size. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't
know. Like people will post a story, like a picture of them or something.
Oh,
and
sure.
And then they'll write it like a line of text, but they'll make it so small you can barely see it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why people do that. Like, I can't see that. Like, I mean, these are some old eyes, but like, I think even a young person would have a hard time.
So people pause and linger longer?
Is that what it is?
I don't know. I mean, if I can't see it immediately, I just skip over it. So
I guess I don't know the function of doing that. And then you'll see people take that story, like, because maybe they were tagged in it, mm-hmm. and then they will repost it and they'll make it even small, you know, because like you can make the post full size or shrink it down.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll make it even smaller. So now it's like, I can't even, I know there's text there, but I can't read it. I don't know what that's about. I just find that shit annoying. Well, you know how I am about when you write illegibly,
mm-hmm,
it's like, well, then don't even write them.
Yeah, you get very bothered.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the point? If you want people to read your words, then write them.
Well, if it's for others, if it's for me, leave me alone about my writing.
Yeah, no, of course. You know, your own chicken scratch is for you. But like, I just find it so odd that I've noticed so many stories where people write like kind of a longish caption. So then, because what I was assuming is like, oh, it's something that maybe they feel like they shouldn't say.
Oh,
so making it smaller makes it more palatable, or
so mom and dad can't read it.
Yeah. Is that why? So you're like, mom and dad can't read.
So you are upset at this unsaid etiquette.
This also makes me, I'm not going to go too hard on this, but the close friends posts,
mm-hmm.
I feel like most of it are pictures that are not allowed on Instagram.
Well, supposedly, yeah.
Which is probably not what they intended that for.
I don't think it's what they intended for. But also, speaking of etiquette, I don't know. many people just like, I haven't had those kind of interactions with these people, and all of a sudden I'm on their close friends. I'm like, okay, interesting.
It is surprising when it's like, oh, I've never met you before, and now I see your
I've never met you before, or I have, and we've never even had a conversation remotely in that realm, and it's like, oh, now I'm seeing your thought pictures.
Okay. Yeah, I see your butt every week.
You're like,
and I see your pubic mound.
I guess you just assumed.
I mean, I guess it's flattering.
It is a compliment, but it's at the same time like, well, it's almost like Emperor's New Clothes. Am I never supposed to say anything? Or I
think that's a little awkward. Like, oh, how am I supposed to? I mean, thank you.
Sure. I'm not responding in kind with my content, but
I don't necessarily. That's not what I have the biggest problem with. Although with close friends, I always think like, oh, people are posting pictures that are not allowed on Instagram.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
but still, not really. It's not like X.
They're
which
not
is
ever
straight up
X,
pornography.
But it's definitely like if you were to post it on your main feed, like it would get removed. So
yes.
I find that funny. But yeah, anyway, my main gripe was stop writing captions in these Instagram stories that are so small we can't read them. That feels like you're scared. Don't even post the shit. Wow. If you feel like you have to be discreet about it, then you probably shouldn't post it.
If you feel there might be political upheaval, please don't put it on your stories.
Moving on to films released we didn't cover. Do not expect too much from the end of the world.
This film, I think you would have been amused by this. It is long. It's 2 hours and 43 minutes from the Romanian filmmaker Radu Jude, which premiered out of Locarno last year. I saw it at AFI. But it's about a production assistant that's working on this video shoot for this huge multi-conglomerate. It's a safety video, and just everything is kind of haywire and over the place. And of course,
who's in it?
Extremely inauthentic. You wouldn't know any of the Romanian actors, but the great German actress Nina Haas does have, considering your work experience, I would highly recommend you watch Nina Haas's portions of this film, because
it sounded interesting.
She pops up in these like work meetings online. It's so good.
Oh god. Next, Riddle of Fire.
This premiered out of Cannes Director's Fortnight this past year, and I missed it there. It's a debut from a filmmaker named Weston Razzouli, and I actually just watched this week. I was gonna review it, but I didn't really care for it. I think it has, it's doing some really interesting things. I like some things in the soundtrack, but it's basically about these three kids. You know how I feel about them. And we follow them on their mischievous adventure through a woodland odyssey while they're getting their sick mother an egg to make her blueberry pie. I think there was a certain faction of the critical elements that decided that this was something cool to like, but it unfortunately was not really for me.
Mm-hmm. Next, Sleeping Dogs.
I mean, I think we just ran out of time because this is something I'm sure you would have been interested in watching, with another bad Russell Crowe movie who's apparently stealing roles from Liam Neeson now as some, I think it's some hitman or assassin that's having memory issues. But it's directed by Adam Cooper, a debut. And based on Mr. Cooper's resume as a screenwriter, this sounds like something terrible because he wrote Ridley Scott's Exodus, Gods and Kings, which even though it stars my girl, I admit is a terrible film. And also Assassin.
Didn't I try to rewatch that recently?
Did you?
I did. Yes, I did.
I mean, it's kind of unwatchable.
I didn't hate it.
I don't hate it. It's not good, though.
What does that say about me? I thought it looks cool, and there's that little gay character, and I like...
Ben Mendelsohn. Yeah, he's fun in it.
And then the... Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks good in the movie.
Pharaoh. Moses. I'd rather we watch Ten Commandments. Oh, and Christian Bale. Yeah. But, you know, there was all that panic about suddenly like, oh yeah, why are we casting white people as Egyptians? And we got,
right,
so yeah. It's like, so then Sigourney got heavily edited out. But I know I've said this before. I knew we were in trouble when Ridley Scott said the visual inspo for her character Toya was Jessica Rabbit. But anyway, Adam Cooper also wrote several terrible films, but Assassin's Creed with Michael Fassbender is wretched. But anyway, so Sleeping Dogs, I still would watch it.
Lastly, You'll Never Find Me.
This is a Shudder film, which, you know, they're can be kind of hit or miss, but this was something that sounded interesting. I think somebody living in a trailer park and a storm happens and a mysterious stranger shows up. Great. Josiah Allen and Indiana Bell are the directors.
That sounds interesting. Mm. There's a project of interest. Someone sent me a something from Deadline that says Kelvin Harrison Jr. and Devine Joy Randolph are in talks to star in an untitled coming-of-age film from director Michael Gondry. Michelle Gondry?
Uh-huh.
What have they done?
Oh my God. Well, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh.
It's probably their largest one. Also has worked with Sigourney in Be Kind Rewind, which I just rewatched recently.
Anyway, the project is a coming-of-age musical set in 1977 Virginia Beach that draws inspiration from Pharrell Williams' childhood. So I guess Kelvin would play Pharrell.
Oh, okay. That could be good. I mean, she's, you know, hot, good getting these roles after this Oscar. Ride that wave.
Lastly, on Patreon last week, we reviewed the film Blind Date, starring Bruce Willis and Kim Basinger. So if you want to hear us talk about a movie we both really didn't like, go to Patreon, and I'll take a break. Unfortunately, there is an entry in the obituary section. Michael Emmett Walsh died.
Yeah, better known as M. Emmett Walsh, very notable character actor. Actually watched two things with him this week, including today's secret film, which was unintentional because he's got a very small part in it. But
he's part of the union.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even.
No, he's part of the plant, not the union.
Yeah, but he's part of the plant. But isn't he one of the people in the union with Fred Ward?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay.
No, he's not in those roles. Not in those parts. He's with the factory boss.
Is he the one? Yeah, he's the one that Kurt Russell tells Meryl, like, well, talk to him. He's the union rep.
Nope.
That's not him.
Nope. He's wearing glasses and he really doesn't have much to do with
this. This is the problem with these stories set in the 70s in Oklahoma and it's nothing but white people in it. I can't tell who's like the same to me. The older ones.
Sure. But M. Emmett Walsh, I mean, we were over Thanksgiving, I think, watched Harry and the Hendersons. Is
he hairy?
He's John Lithgow's dad in Harry and the Hendersons.
Oh, he looks like he could be John Lithgow's dad.
Uh-huh. I always think of the movie Blood Simple, the Coen brothers debut with him. But yeah, just like a very impressive resume. We watched My Best Friend's Wedding. Well, rewatched. He's got a small part in that. Oh. But yeah, he's been around for a long time.
Well, goodbye, sir.
Yeah.
The secret film this week was your choice, and I've probably already given it away, but yeah. You chose the 1983 American biographical drama Silkwood, directed by Mike Nichols.
The great Mike Nichols.
So I didn't know who Mike Nichols was, so I looked him up, and I realized that I've enjoyed a couple of his films.
Yeah.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Uh-huh.
Working Girl.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Oh, The Birdcage.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's it. My God. Like one of the most important American
Never
directors ever.
For me.
Wow. His debut, The Graduate.
I haven't seen that.
Oh my God. Well, that's got to be a secret. You can't have not seen The Graduate.
Is Catch 22 based off the book?
Yeah, by Joseph Heller.
Oh, I read the book.
Okay. I think John Voight's. I've never seen the film version.
Oh, Biloxi Blues?
I've never seen that with Matthew.
I do like Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick, yeah. I think it's important to know. Oh, Carnal Knowledge is great. That's Anne Margaret, one of her Oscar nominated roles. Candice Bergen, Young and Beautiful.
Bergen.
How dare you talk that way about bourbon?
I like when you say burger.
Burger. So Mike Nichols hadn't directed a feature since 1975. And that was, I went through a Mike Nichols phase as a kid. And I remember he's a major director.
You have a phase for everything. You collected shells from the beach. You like dinosaurs.
Yes.
You would take bugs to school. You went through a bug collecting phase.
Oh yeah. And I was growing mold in my room. I would catch caterpillars so I could... I harvested several successful butterflies.
Oh.
Anyway, I was busy little child. And then, so you can see why I am the way I am today. He did a film in 75 with Warren.
Help me.
Stop that now. With Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson and a very young Stockard Channing called The Fortune, which was not very well received. Mm. And so I think he directed a stand-up special for Gilda Radner in that absence. But so Silkwood's really kind of a regeneration of his career because he had a pretty damn good 80s. And it's notable that it's his first time working with Meryl Streep, who he'd worked with three times. And then, of course, Nora Ephron. This was her first screenwriting debut, co-written by Alice Arlen. And she would go on to work with Meryl several times. Notably, they all worked together right after this in a story about Efron's own divorce called Heartburn with Meryl's with Jack Nicholson.
Well, let's get through Silkwood. The premise: a worker at a plutonium processing plant is purposefully contaminated, psychologically tortured, and possibly murdered to prevent her from exposing worker safety violations at the plant. That's the entire movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep is that worker.
Karen Silkwood.
And this plutonium plant is in Oklahoma. The story's set in like the mid-70s.
74.
And it just starts like everyone's just working, but we see that conditions there are not ideal. Like the workers really aren't treated that well. It's clear like work-life balance is not of any importance to the plant, which is called Kerr McGee
in the film. Yeah,
in the film. So she at a point starts asking questions like, why don't we do this, why don't we do that? And then she everything starts because she makes it known that she wants like the weekend off
to visit her three children,
which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. But her boss tells her no because we're behind schedule, blah, blah, blah. But then she's able to switch with a coworker and she takes the weekend off, which doesn't go as planned, which we'll get to. But when she comes back to work on Monday, she's told that, the lady who's supposed to cover her shift, she goes, oh, I didn't have to do it because the plant shut down. Why? Because there was a contamination. When? Right after you left, girl. not to upset you, but just so you know, everyone thinks you did it so you wouldn't have to work this weekend. So that sort of starts like this animosity towards her. Then she has an incident where she becomes contaminated, and we can get into all of that. But slowly she starts getting sick. During this time, she also joins the union mm-hmm. and starts asking a lot of questions. She gets transferred to a different department and learns that more dirty shit's going on, like people tampering with like reports and not following safety protocol, specifically related to the decontamination process. Mm-hmm. She ends up going to DC to like a big union meeting, and she spills all the beans. Like, yeah, they're tampering with this and not doing this. And they're like, well, how about this? We're going to get a reporter to do like a big expose on it, but you have to get evidence. So she's trying, and everyone can tell that she's snooping around. She ends up getting really sick. Her home ends up becoming contaminated with this radioactive material. And then she, like the night before she's supposed to do this interview with the New York reporter, she goes to the plant one last time to get some like documents. And as she's leaving the plant,
And then she goes to a union meeting. I think it's they fashion it as when she's leaving the meeting.
She gets into a fatal car accident, but the way the film is telling it, because this is based on a true story, we don't know for sure what happened, but the film makes it seem like someone ran her off the road. Mm-hmm. And then we learn that in the true story that in her, this woman's car, Meryl's character's name is
Karen Silkwood.
Oh yeah. That's where Silkwood comes from. That there were no documents in her car and that it was deemed an accident, and that the toxicology report showed that she had like a tranquilizer and alcohol in her system. So it's not really clear what happened. The film doesn't mention it, but you know, upon further research, this woman's family, they did win a settlement, like a wrongful death suit. I think the settlement was $10 million, but of course the plant fought it, and ultimately the family accepted like a little over $1 million. But I knew nothing about this movie. You know what I think I thought this movie was going to be like? I'm going to sound so stupid, but I think I thought this was like Sophie's Choice.
Well, that's what she did right before this.
And I know that this is not Sophie's Choice because I know that it's called Sophie's Choice. But for some reason, I thought this was going to be like this super melodramatic like love story. And
Sophie's Choice is great.
But really, this is more of, it kind of is like a procedural, kind of.
Yeah, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. My overall thought is this feels like a TV movie with really good actors in it.
Uh-huh.
But it left me wanting in some areas.
Sure, but I think they were trying hard to humanize this woman who had some complicated relationships and made lots of questionable choices.
But Meryl Streep does a fantastic job in this role. Cher is great. Looks great. Mm-hmm. Of course, seeing Kurt Russell's fun, and he's shirtless in a lot of it.
Yep. I think, is this his only Golden Globe nominated performance?
Which I don't know that he had much to do.
No, but it's nice to see him in something of this ilk.
I enjoyed watching the movie.
This silk ilk.
Yeah, I think it's very good.
A great supporting cast. There's all kinds of recognizable faces in there.
Should I just start going through my notes? Because I have a lot of them.
Oh,
first of all, it was so funny to me that everyone's so concerned about cancer, mm-hmm. especially Meryl, because she's the one fighting for like worker safety. But all I kept thinking was like, all that smoking she's doing,
she stays smoking in this.
That's gonna kill her before this goddamn plutonium.
My God,
every scene.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
She gave Betty Davis a run for her money. Like every scene she's smoking. And even at a point, Kurt tells her, like, you're so worried about cancer, maybe you want to put that cigarette down.
Yeah.
And that while he's smoking with her.
Right.
It was too much. I thought Meryl was so cute. When we first meet her, it seems like people at the plant like her well enough, but she's kind of annoying.
Yeah.
Because she's kind of a busybody. We see her like on their lunch break, and she's roaming around the lunchroom eating everyone's lunch.
Yeah.
But the way everyone's reacting to her is like, this is a very common thing.
This is what she does.
Yeah. That she doesn't bring her own shit, and then she just grazes everyone else's lunch. Because mm-hmm. several people just kind of hold up like a little piece of whatever they're eating to give to her. oh God, Meryl trying to switch her shift at work, because we're told that the plant,
they're behind on contracts.
Whomever they're providing this material to, they're behind, and it's a big deal for like compensation that they get these things done on time. So everyone's working doubles, everyone's working on the weekends. So of course she's not given the day off, and no one wants to switch with her, but someone does. But it gave me flashbacks of when I used to work, when I worked in the casino before I worked in VIP services. Because when I worked in VIP services, I never wanted the day off because I made so much money. Mm-hmm. But when I worked the front desk and I was like least, like I was almost the lowest bottom of seniority, I could never get the day off. And switching with people was impossible. Mm-hmm. That like 6 months that I worked there was the, like, it was just so unbelievable. Like, so I can never... So I just can never have a Sunday off then.
Yeah, never. You don't have seniority. Yeah. And I remember in college, I worked over a year without a weekend off.
Isn't that crazy? Like, mm-hmm. What kind of, like, how long do you think someone's going to last?
Well, they don't care.
But yeah, like, I just, we can, if there's time at the end, we can talk about these working situations. But it just is so crazy to me that these employers, like, how long do you expect someone to be happy?
They don't.
When they can't.
Just a body to do their bidding.
So I'll never have I'll never be able to go out Saturday night is what you're telling me. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like, wow.
I mean, when I was in that boat, I still was going out, but you run yourself ragged. Yeah.
So this plutonium plant, you know, we get the sense that these are like maybe people who, these jobs mean a lot to them. Like they wouldn't be able to make this kind of money anywhere else in the region.
Which is fucked up because it's still, they're not making that much really.
It would seem that they're not making a killing.
It's based just, on the living situation of Meryl and Cher. Yeah.
But certainly they're making more money than they would otherwise.
Yeah.
And the only character, so there's one character named Thelma, this old racist ass lady.
Played by Sudie Bond.
Who seems concerned because we hear about her daughter dying of cancer. But she said, Meryl sees her. And the reason we learn about her daughter is Meryl's like, your hair looks different. And Thelma goes, I gave my daughter my good wig. And then she goes on to say, can you believe they're making my daughter die next to a colored person? I was like, oh Lord.
Yeah.
Let her get radiation poisoning.
Yeah, when she does.
Oh my gosh. The scene when Meryl comes back after her weekend off and everyone's looking at her with side eye because they think she contaminated so she could get the day off. But talking about her weekend, so what do we know about Meryl's character? She has three children. Mm-hmm. She had a common law husband who she divorced, and now that husband and her kids live in Texas. Mm-hmm. So it would seem that Meryl took this job at the plant because it's good money, but of course she's sacrificing being around her kids. But she drags Kurt and Cher with her, and the plan was they were going to like rent a hotel by the beach and spend the weekend with her kids. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was really sweet, like these three people living together, and it seemed like they had a nice little thing going.
This little chosen family.
Yeah, but they get to her baby daddy's house and he's like, the fuck y'all doing here? Oh, well, I'm taking the kids to the beach for the weekend. Well, you should have asked me because we're going to my dad's house. And Meryl's like, well, I asked your wife and she said I could have them.
Well, who's played by Tess Harper.
And he's like, well, you should have asked me. So then, of course, that ruins Meryl's trip, and she takes the kids to lunch, and then she drives back home that same night. So ultimately, she didn't even need the full weekend off.
Right.
But I thought that was pretty sad. Although that, we get Meryl Streep singing Amazing Grace twice, mm-hmm. and the first time we get it is her driving back from Texas mm-hmm. in the rain at night. Meryl has a beautiful voice, she obviously, does. But I don't know that I needed her singing Amazing Grace.
Oh, well, I think it's, I remember, I haven't seen this since I was a teenager, but I remember thinking it was powerful at the end.
So Thelma, the old racist lady, she ends up getting exposure to radiation. And so the scene where she has to be scrubbed. There are what, three or four scrubbing scenes?
Yes, that have been parodied all over the place.
And I can see why.
Yeah.
They are really extreme. These people are acting like the way everyone's acting, because we see Thelma get scrubbed, then we see Meryl get scrubbed twice. Both of them are just acting like someone's trying to kill them.
Well, I mean, it's pretty intense. But
the first time Meryl, she's complaining and acting all crazy, and then is smoking
right, like, after
smoking a cigarette while she's sitting there with the doctor. But anyway, when Thelma gets exposure, Cher runs to tell Meryl, and she's like, Thelma's cooked. I thought that was funny. Okay, Fred Ward is in the thing.
Oh, I love young and handsome.
And he told a joke that I thought was so funny, because he was, in his words, he was saying like how the Indian chief named, was talking to his son about how he named everyone. Mm-hmm. And basically it was like, well, I named you after like, what I saw at the time. Yeah. So it was like beautiful names, like two birds by the river, moon in the sky. And then the dad asked his son, tell me, two dogs fucking, why are you so interested? I thought that was so funny, because it felt like a joke you would tell during that period.
During that time. Yeah. In this place. Yes.
Like, oh, you know, love Kurt Russell, but his ass with that damn Confederate flag over the bed.
Oh yeah, he carried that around, because we see him move somewhere else and he take that flag and with
he
him.
He made sure that flag was up. Mm-hmm. But then, so apparently Cher, or I'm sorry, Meryl and Kurt, who live with Cher, didn't know Cher was a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And one night Cher comes home like late, like stumbles home from the bar, clearly with a hookup. Mm-hmm. And they're like having sex and making noise. So the next morning, when everyone wakes up, Meryl and Kurt are kind of ribbing Cher, like, oh, you seemed to have fun last night. And she's like, well, it's not like I haven't heard you two. And so then you expect to see a man come out of the bedroom, but it's a woman, and not any woman. It's Christina Crawford.
It's Diana Scarwood. Yes.
And I thought that was so cute, because Kurt and Meryl are looking like, oh, hey.
Yeah, they're stunned.
And then Cher leaves with her. So now the two of them are in the house, and then they have a conversation about Cher being a lesbian. And it's actually Kurt who's like, well, I don't have a problem with it. And then Meryl's like, well, then why are we talking about it if we don't have a problem with it? But I thought it felt really sweet, like this little family they made. And then, you know, because Kurt just comes across as like a good old boy.
Yeah.
But clearly he seems, I mean, if he's fine with this lesbian, gypsy tramp and thief. But,
well, then Diana Scarwood moves in.
And then
who's a
Christina Crawford's character?
A beautician.
Is a beautician. So, and she look, and she's cute. So I'm like, oh yeah, she's like a hairdresser. But then we get a scene where she does Cher's makeup. And to give you a sense of how she looks, Kurt tells her she looks like a fucking corpse. And that's when we learn that Christina Crawford is a beautician at the morgue. I laughed because Cher did look like a corpse.
Well, right before he said that, I'm like, God, she looks dead.
And Meryl goes, what's the base, like the foundation that you're using? And then this bitch goes, oh, the same one I use for everyone.
Yeah, and that's before we know.
That's before we know she worked at the morgue, because it's like, oh, so you use cremation number 4 on everyone. Mm-hmm. Okay. She looked crazy. Okay. So after Meryl gets in trouble and is contaminated, she gets transferred to the metallography section mm-hmm. of the plant. And that's the section that Craig T. Nelson mm-hmm. runs. And immediately we see he's a creep.
Yes.
Gosh, this the main takeaway I got from this movie is just like these like unsavory ass conditions these people had to work in. Like, this plant doesn't give a shit about these people's health, their life. And then it's like, not only that, but then these women are being harassed by these greasy ass men. But we find out that Craig's character, he's supposed to be taking like photographs of the finished product to see if there are any imperfections, because that could really affect like their stability or something. Mm-hmm. But then at a point we see that he's been tampering with the negatives. So he sees that there are imperfections, and then he's been instructed to like basically use a pen to fill them in.
Yeah, he doctors the negatives.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, yeah, but I believe it.
Oh,
I believe it. They want to get this contract satisfied.
So this is when Meryl decides to join the union. And then she's active. She's going to a meeting and taking notes and asking everyone, like, what are you happy about? And she is successful in, because step one is like the union out in DC is telling them that there's going to be a vote And it's very important that your coworkers vote to keep the union. So they are successful. Mm-hmm. But after they win the vote, everyone's kind of like, okay, can you stop now? Because you're causing too much of a ruckus and we don't want to lose our jobs. So now people are kind of annoyed with Meryl.
Even though that's the point of the union.
Right. And then she flies to DC for the union meeting. And it was so cute because you could tell the Meryl hasn't been on a plane before. Mm-hmm. But she goes with Fred Ward and that other guy. And they're greeted by Ron Silver, mm-hmm. who I remember because I thought he was so handsome in the movie The Entity.
Oh, with Barbara Hershey.
Where yeah. Barbara Hershey's character gets sexually assaulted by a ghost.
You should. Oh, we need to watch Reversal of Fortune.
That was actually our very first YouTube review. I don't recommend watching it because it's crunchy as hell. But
was that the first?
It's either. Yeah, it was the first.
I thought it was Midsommar.
I think Midsommar is the second.
Oh.
Well, it's one or the other.
Okay.
But I'm almost sure The Entity is our first one that I published. We might have recorded Midsommar first. But yeah, I thought Ron Silver was so handsome, but that union meeting was so uncomfortable, but it felt very accurate. Mm-hmm. I've never worked somewhere where I was part of a union, but stories I hear from people I know who are, and then, but even just like talking to HR, where they just seem so like, uh-huh, yeah, and it's not until you tell them something good that they get excited.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, we can get someone in trouble for that. Like, just give me proof.
Yeah, otherwise they're just like, yeah, complaining about the showers. Like, okay, boring. And they're like, oh, they're doctoring negatives.
But then when they get, yeah, because they didn't seem to care about like worker conditions as much as like bigger things that they could like really cause a scandal about. But when they get back from their trip, they're showing pictures to everyone. Mm-hmm. And we see that there are a few pictures with Meryl hugged up on Ron Silver.
Oh, yeah, just indiscriminately.
And Kurt looks so mad. And then shortly after that, he quits working at the plant and moves out of the house.
Yeah.
So he was real mad.
Yeah.
So then we have the big union meeting where the people from DC come. And I just thought, God, these reps are not good at making people feel seen and heard. Like, and the way they're explaining shit to them is like, do you want these people to be happy with you? Or
right.
God, you always so terrible at your jobs. Cheryl
Streep.
Cher and Meryl get into an argument because now Meryl's upset because Kurt left and work's going poorly. Meryl's annoyed with Cher because Christina Crawford's always at the house. And at one point, oh, she's mad because Christina Crawford lost the key to the house. Uh-huh. And she's saying, well, here, you can borrow my key, but make sure you put it back because I don't want to, like, you leave the door unlocked and someone comes in and rapes me. And Cher tells Meryl, who's going to rape you that you ain't already fucked? That took me out. Then we see that Christina Crawford leaves Cher to go back to her husband. Just messy. Mm-hmm. It's all so messy.
It's messy. Yeah, I mean.
Then Cher and Meryl are still arguing, and Cher tells Meryl, you took about as good care of Drew, who's Kurt's character, as you did of your own kids. Like, we both shouted out like, ooh. But they end up making up. Meryl gets contaminated again. And that scrub down scene, because she's also starting to look sick. Mm-hmm. Like, they're making her look, sometimes she looks really red, and then sometimes she looks ghostly. Mm-hmm. Ugh. Then we get to her house, and we see that now her house is contaminated.
Not the car.
So then Meryl has a theory. She thinks, because when she first got contaminated, they told her, oh, you have to do weekly urine tests. So she would, and they said, make sure you take it home and do it. Mm-hmm. So then when they come to test her house, they're like, yeah, you have like traces of radiation in these weird places. So we have to basically strip the house. But then Meryl has the bright idea that, oh, I bet someone's contaminating my urine sample container. Mm-hmm. Because we see one day she spilled the urine.
Yeah.
And then got it all over shit. So that's why those places were contaminated. But of course, you know, the film is showing that, but there was no proof of that. But you know, I do think that a weakness of the story was that the first couple of times she gets contaminated, it was just very much like, well, how did that happen? Like, mm-hmm. So then looking back at, Because if the inside of the...
Well, that's supposed to be the paranoid part of it, is that somebody might have been doing that to her as a way to punish her.
Right, but I guess I wanted more of that. Like, I wanted to feel a little more like dread and suspense. It just kind of felt like out of nowhere. Like, oh, because every time she leaves certain areas, she has to like go past this monitor that can detect radiation, mm-hmm. and it goes off, and it just felt so jarring. Like,
ugh.
Where was she? Like, how could this have happened? I kind of wish that we would have got a little bit more for that, maybe. Then they end up going to Texas to be seen by real doctors, because they're concerned that the doctor at the plant is not doing his due diligence. So they go to Texas, and then they go to this fancy place, and the three of them share Kurt and Meryl, and mm-hmm. they do all these tests. And when they get the results, those doctors seem like they don't know what the hell they're talking about either.
Right.
Which gave me anxiety. Like, I mean, I was frustrated for them. I really did enjoy, I kind of wish this would have been more of a like suspenseful procedural on how this woman is being slowly taken down. But instead, it's like half that, half like melodrama.
Sure.
Like, it kind of felt like a soap opera.
Sure.
Which is why I think it felt like a TV movie to me.
Okay.
I'm saying it felt like a TV movie, but I do think it's very well done. And it did receive critical acclaim.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's, I think, 5 Academy Award nominations, including director, of course, for Meryl, who lost to Shirley MacLaine this year.
For what?
Terms of Endearment.
Oh, my mom likes that movie.
Yeah, that's some melodrama. Cher was nominated. She won a Golden Globe. And
Cher is pretty.
It's fun seeing her. I mean, this is a fun period because people are finally starting to take her seriously because of this. And one of my favorite Altmans, which has come back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, which Sudie Bond, who plays Thelma, is also in that film.
Oh.
So there's a lot that I like about it. I think I have fond memories of being a kid and, you know, really discovering all of these 80s classics, you know, and because if Karen Silkwood's story were made today, it would be in a much different, a different style, I'm pretty sure. But it's fun seeing all these people, you know, David Strathairn, Bruce McGill.
David Strathairn reminded me of someone. He's quite handsome, but
yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I couldn't put my finger on who I think he reminded me of.
Will Patton, Anthony Heald is in a little role. So, yeah, I don't know. There's just, and it's just funny to think, like, I think Sophie's Choice had wrapped not 2 weeks or so prior to this film starting production.
Oh.
So Meryl was technically only one Oscar in when she was making this, but because, of course, she would win for Sophie's Choice. But, yeah, I don't know. It's just an interesting time with interesting people.
What would you give Silkwood?
3.5.
I would give it 3.5 out of 5. I thought it was very good.
Oh, and Bill Cobbs.
Bill Cobbs?
One of the only black men.
Oh, who we know from The Bodyguard.
Yeah.
He played Rachel's, Whitney. Well, Rachel Marin, Whitney Houston's character.
Mm-hmm.
He played her like manager.
Well, I was thinking of him in People Under the Stairs as well. But yeah, he had a small part as well.
Well, I think that's all we have. Are you reading anything?
I'm still reading Group Portrait with Lady, which is very dense. And yeah, that's about it at the moment.
All right. Are we all done?
Sure.
Ta-ta.